I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new album celebrates the music of Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe. Counterpoint Lerner and Lowe features Dick Hyman on piano and Ken Peplowski on clarinet and tenor sax in duet, doing improvisations of songs from Brigadoon, Gigi, My Fair Lady, Camelot, Paint Your Wagon, and The Day Before Spring. Mr. Hyman joins me now in a conversation we taped a few weeks ago to talk about his collaboration with Mr. Peplowski, who is considered one of the great clarinetists of our time, someone who, it has been said, fills the void in the time since Benny Goodman's death. We talk about what makes the music of Lerner and Lowe so conducive to improvisation. I ask Dick about his own musicianship, what contrapuntal is, as well as his remarkable career. Dick Hyman has worked as a pianist, organist, arranger, music director, and composer. His career began in the early 1950s after graduating from Columbia University in 1948. He was music director for Arthur Godfrey and organist on the television program Beat the Clock, and was the composer of original music scores for Moonstruck, The Purple Rose of Cairo, Bullets Over Broadway, and Stardust Memories. He was a frequent guest on A Prairie Home Companion. He has worked as a soloist, arranger, music director for a myriad of artists, from Count Basie, the Mills Brothers, Tony Bennett, Margaret Whiting, Doc Severinsen, Barry Manilow, Pearl Bailey, Billie Holiday, Perez Prado, Kate Smith, as well as two of my favorites, Sylvia Sims and Bobby Short. He received an Emmy and is a member of the Jazz Hall of Fame of the Rutgers Institute and the New Jersey Jazz Society. In 2017, he received the Jazz Master Award from the National Endowment of the Arts, as well as an honorary doctorate from the Juilliard School of Music. This new album is from Arbor's Records and is available online and stores now. Visit Dick's website at dickhyman.com. There are so many Lerner and Lowe favorites on this album. They Call the Wind Maria, I Could Have Danced All Night, Gigi, I Talked to the Trees, Almost Like Being in Love, On the Street Where You Live, and Thank Heaven for Little Girls, among others. We'll play his solo of Gigi out of the interview. I reached him from his home in Venice, Florida. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Dick Hyman. Mr. Hyman, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for calling.
Thanks for joining us. How do you explain this concept of contrapuntal? Is that how you pronounce it, by the way?
Well, sure. Well, you know, contrapuntal means the adjective for a counterpoint.
Uh-huh.
And counterpoint is two moving parts in music that have a relationship with each other. It can be more than two, but what we've done in the album with Ken Peplowski and myself is, of course, two lines. I'm able to do a little more on the piano, but basically it's a two-line simultaneous composition.
And you've worked with Ken before, right?
Well, I've worked with Ken for a long time. We've made recordings before this, but this is the first time I think we've been able to improvise very freely on some given material, and then entirely without material, just intuiting what each other is liable to play and go along with that and trying to complement it.
And this is something that I'm having trouble understanding. So these are improvisations. These aren't things that you and
Ken...
Well,
they are, yes, yeah. Yes and no. The way it worked, I wrote arrangements of each given Lerner and Lowe song.
Uh-huh.
The whole album, you know, is songs by Lerner and Lowe. And I wrote a couple of pages of exact stuff, and then some very general suggestions of where we might go after that music had run out. In other words, what I wrote was really just a launching pad for free improvisation after that.
And I guess because you've known Ken for and worked with him for a long time, it's easy for you guys to play together.
Well, we've done it. You know, we played in clubs and we played in concerts, and it was always pleasant and easy, as you say. But it's become more unexpected and interesting,
yeah,
because we now dare to go into some territory that mostly two people playing against each other, with each other, but against each other would not be able to do.
The music of Lerner and Lowe, I mean, you know, we think back to My Fair Lady and how many albums came out of that, you know, artists improvising and the sort. Well, what is it about Lowe's music that makes it so versatile?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, it's melodic, of course,
uh-huh,
as it has to be in order to be singable at its best. But it also has occasional intriguing chord changes and recurrent patterns. It makes it good for jazz people to hang on to those elements and to maybe go a little farther in one direction or another than the song itself goes. We like to find some little bit about it and then play everything we can around that element, and then get each other to play more ways and get farther and farther away from it and then maybe return to it. It's hard to describe what you do when you're improvising, but all those things are part of the process.
And the other thing that I was listening to the album is you guys sound like you're having fun. Are the sessions like that for you?
Well, they are. They have been. And I do believe that at least in our kind of music, you should be having fun. Even if it's demanding music, you should be enjoying it and having a sense of exploration and perhaps humor, or at any rate, some sort of feeling. It's not just automatic.
Yeah.
When as it happens, if you're improvising and you hit on something unexpectedly nice and together, it's a very satisfying feeling. We like to get those moments.
Yeah. Now, the song Gigi appears on the album twice, and both versions are just great. I guess there's one where it's Ken with a sax solo, and then you with a piano solo. I guess it was hard to choose which to put on the album?
Well, no, that's not quite how it... First of all, we made Ken's tenor sax solo with piano accompaniment.
Uh-huh.
And that was, we did that in one take. And then I had the vague idea that maybe since he was the soloist altogether on that and was featured, I would do a comparable thing in a slightly different manner. So I changed key and I went into my own solo version of it. That also took only one take.
Really? Yeah.
Most of the other things we did in two or three takes.
Yeah.
Until it's the best.
And I guess it just feels right, doesn't it, when you know that's when to stop, right?
Well, you know, when you record in a studio, you have to be aware that... you can only be picky for so long. You don't want to antagonize everybody in the studio, the rest of the orchestra, and the people in the control room, and everybody by calling for yet another take, although some artists have been known to do that. So you do have to restrain yourself from correcting yourself in an unlimited manner.
Yeah. One of the delightful aspects of preparing for our chat was finding out other things you've done in your career, and you wrote the theme to The Purple Rose of Cairo, and it's such a beautiful piece of music.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I did that, and a lot of other films for Woody Allen,
uh-huh,
and you know, whatever the background music was required, I tried to do it my best. We did the theme for the film, and then we did action music or sly commentary kind of music. And occasionally, because Woody was used to that, we used people we use were recordings that he liked, and we stuck them in there too.
And so would there be a great discussion as to what recordings you would use? Like, take Hannah and Her Sisters, for example. The version of You Made Me Love You, that's Harry James. Why him instead of someone else, say?
Oh, well, Woody selected all them.
I see.
I didn't have a choice in that matter. But Woody had, for a long time, scored entire films just with old phonograph records.
Right.
So he's a great enthusiast of all sorts of music, pop music and jazz music both. And he knows his way around the repertoire very well. My contributions came in at a later point. I was able to be more, answer more exacting needs for underscoring than just playing some record in the background.
Now, I mentioned Hannah and Her Sisters. There's a scene there where Lloyd Nolan and Maureen O'Sullivan sing. Did you work with them on that?
Yes. If there's any singing to be done and created, of course, the music director, in my case, the music director was the music arranger. You have to know what you're doing. So we would have a rehearsal, and I would write a great, and then we would record it, possibly record it a number of different ways until we got it just with the right feel.
Yeah. Now, you also worked with Benny Goodman, and you know, Ken's a clarinet player. Do people ask you to compare the two?
Well, you know, Benny Goodman is Ken's idol as well as mine, and I was, from a very early age, my big brother, who was 6 years older than me, introduced me to Benny Goodman's music, and took me to a performance of Benny at the Paramount Theater way, way back. And we actually met Benny in the elevator as we were going up to meet him more formally. But he said hi, and then he got off the elevator. But it was a thrill.
Yeah.
And I was that age when it was very impressionable. Benny was, in fact, has been one of my great idols. And I've learned a lot from not only from playing with him now and then, but certainly from just studying his older records.
Right, right. Someone who I'm 37, so I'm coming to all these things backwards in terms of finding, discovering artists and the sort. And two of my favorites are Bobby Short and Sylvia Sims. And so you did an album with Sylvia Sims, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. And I knew Bobby Short, and I've done various work with him as well. I did an album with Sylvia Sims. Let's see.
Would have been in the 70s, I guess, right?
Yeah, I can't at the moment think of the theme of the album. Perhaps you know?
It was called Lovingly.
Hmm.
And Sweet Georgia Brown was on it, and
Oh, right.
And I just liked listening to her, and you know, I later learned that Sinatra was a great admirer of hers. What was she like to work with?
She was very, very pleasant. Most artists in the recording studio are very pleasant. She knew she didn't demand anything that was unreasonable. Uh-huh. Rarely does an artist do that, anyhow. It's all very a loving relationship, at least for the 3 hours that you're together. And I've always enjoyed recording. It allows you, although there is an excitement and a good deal of luck and good fortune if you get a great live performance,
uh-huh,
and that can happen. In a recording studio, you can go after some finer points and maybe do the thing several times, just get it just the way you want. And live, it doesn't always work that way, although it may be very fortunate. But you want to get the right tempo, the right feeling, the right emotion. A lot of those things emerge after you spend a little time on the song, not just if you go out and do your best.
Yeah. And this album with Ken Poplawski, there's obviously a lot of hard work and preparation that one has to do, but I mean, how much luck and good fortune can one hear, say, it as they listen to the finished album?
Well, I would say that the preparation lasts in each case about a minute, maybe 2 minutes, maybe 2 minutes at the most, and then the rest of it is luck and good fortune. And from knowing each other as well as we now do, we're able to sort of dare each other to go this way or that way, or change the focus suddenly on something. He will play something that I will adapt and use as an accompaniment, and he'll play something on top of that, and then I may alter it, or suddenly one of us may go into another groove entirely, and we now know what we can do, and we now try each other. We try to inspire each other in more ways than we had the nerve to do a few years ago.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful way. I mean, the idea of improvisation, it's a wonderful way to lead one's life too. Don't you think there are lessons in there for the rest of us? I guess.
Well, now you're into something. Well, you know, I guess I don't. You're getting into philosophy now. Leads one's life through improvisation is maybe not the best way to do it, but you have to allow enough time for it.
Right.
Or else you'll just be aiming at something all the time and working too hard. You have to lean back, as they say, and enjoy the moment.
I guess
that's the analogy.
Yeah, and I guess you just have to be prepared for every possibility. I guess that's a better way to look at life, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. I'd have to think about that. That's a very interesting question, and off the top of my head, I'd have to think about whether life should be improvised or composed.
Right.
Some combination, no doubt.
Indeed. Another person that you worked with in your career was Arthur Godfrey. For a lot of people, I mean, he's not as remembered as he should be. Were you there that time that he fired Julius LaRosa?
No, that was after my time.
I see.
Godfrey, it is interesting that his image has faded so much, but for those people who don't really remember what all the Godfrey myth was about, Godfrey was a radio guy who, I don't know if he was the original first pioneer, I doubt that, but he had an unparalleled way of attracting an audience with just a wonderful voice, personality, and he made me his musical director at a certain point. I succeeded some very prestigious other people like Archie Blyer, I inherited and also added a couple of players to a wonderful studio band. And we had a little music cow every morning. Uh-huh. Godfrey would sing a little. Whoever was featured as the singer on the show would sing a song. The band would play one or two numbers. We would accompany Godfrey. We would have a sort of a jam session, feature one of the musicians. All sorts of ways. It was very nicely planned by the producer and by Godfrey. And we were trying to present ourselves as having a good time in the studio,
yeah.
but in fact we were.
Yeah.
It was a very nice way to spend the day. And after, and I'm going way back now, and after it became possible to tape programs in a studio, we might do three of them in a day then, later on. But at times also we did them with a live audience, and that in itself had a characteristic to certain radio shows. In time, Godfrey moved on to television, and I stayed with him and arranged and conducted and played piano or organ with the band on television.
Yeah, and it'd be just a huge deal, both on radio and television in those years. And I mentioned, for people listening to us, Julius LaRosa was a vocalist on the show, and I guess there was a conflict between them, and he fired him on the air. And
that was the great dramatic gesture that happened sometime, as I say, a little bit before my time.
Yeah.
But in my time, we had Carmel Quinn frequently on the program as a singer. And also, it was the kind of program where Godfrey would expect that you would exchange lines with him.
Mm.
You would have perhaps speak a little about any question that he asked you, or go off on a bit of a tangent, maybe, or have a dialogue, in other words, friendly dialogue.
Yeah.
And every now and then, Godfrey would beautifully lead into a commercial. And he was a very successful salesperson for the many, many sponsors he had over the years.
Yeah, Lipton soup, Lipton tea. And just an appealing figure to listen to, and obviously to watch years later. Dick, it's such a great album, and it ends with "Thank Heaven for Little Girls," which is a song that a lot of us recognize. It sounds like a great finale, but at the same time, as I'm listening to it, it sounds like there should be an encore if this was a concert. Are you working on another album now?
Well, no, we haven't. You know, that's fairly recent. We only recorded that in March,
uh-huh.
so we haven't really thought about a second album. We'll see how this one goes, and it is going well at this point.
Indeed. And I understand that you were both in New York recently to launch the album. Is that right?
Yeah, we, with the help of our mutual friend Bill Charlotte, we took one night of the two that Bill was performing in Dizzy's, the full name of Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola. And Ken and I played a lot of things from the album, and then Bill joined in on second piano, and we had some wonderful three-way playing in a very unlikely combo.
Mm-hmm.
Two pianos and a clarinet isn't very common, but it worked fine. We knew each other. We know each other very well.
Yeah. Is playing for you, especially in front of an audience, is that still fun for you?
It is. An audience always inspires you to play. I mean, to use an old-fashioned and not too complimentary term, an audience inspires you to show off, to show what you have and to try to please them. There are some other aspects of performing that an audience inspires. I mean, you don't want to continually show off and not play anything of substance. and at times you have to involve the audience and get them to understand, and you don't do this too verbally, but in your playing, you get them to understand what you're trying to do. This is all nonverbal. In other words, you might announce a tune and say, I'm now going to play some variations on this, And I found you might go on, you can play the song this way, you can play it that way, and so forth. You can, I believe, in letting the audience in on what it is you're trying to do, because they can reciprocate and really be very thankful to you, complimentary to you, if you involve them. I like that. Mm. On the other hand, there are things that are better done solo, really, isolated in a studio, and that's when I do my real composing. Some of which is really kind of deadly, demanding work.
Yeah.
Getting something right after trying it out, different ways and different days, I may say.
Yeah.
Many times over. There is that in music too, but you try to balance the demands of that sort of work with the fun you can have playing for people.
Yeah.
And that's how it works out.
For you, I mean, do you play every day? Do you find the need to have to play every day, say?
Oh, I practice every day.
Yeah.
Even if I don't, as I did not up until last week, and I had a couple of months where I really didn't have anything demanded of me. But you have to be in shape so that when something is demanded of you, you can do it. So I practice every day, and I write quite a bit every day.
Yeah.
And I plan and I organize. It's not all fun and games. A lot of it is pretty serious paperwork and preparation.
Yeah. What do you enjoy listening to?
Well, I recently had my sound system upgraded, and I've been very happy with the sound now of classical recordings, Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It'd be too many things for me to tell you, but I enjoy listening to a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I guess it's not just stuff that you play. You do find, as you mentioned, Rachmaninoff, for example, you can find something edifying or helpful for you, I guess, as you
work.
Well,
of course, when you're listening to a piano, a recording of piano, that's always inspiring, and maybe you can crib a little bit of that, or at least sink back and admire it and marvel at the technique of the pianist. But I like to listen to, for example, Stravinsky wrote pieces way, way back in 1912, for example, that sound so much ahead of their time. It was just amazing to compare that sort of music with what's come later on.
Indeed. Dick, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations on this album. It's a terrific album. I appreciate your time today.
You're very kind. I enjoyed speaking with you, and I think we had fun in the same way as I have fun when I'm playing a nice duet.
Visit DickHyman.com. The album is called Counterpoint Learner and Low, featuring Dick Hyman and Ken Piplowski. Dick Hyman joined me on the line from Venice, Florida, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.